sat and stared wide-eyed at the abbot.
I don't believe it.
What, about the Pope? I didn't either, but I heard it earlier, and New Rome has had time to deny it. They haven't said a word.
What does it mean?
Isn't that obvious? The Vatican Diplomatic Service is on the job. Evidently, they sent in a report on the Guam Conference. Evidently, it horrified the Holy Father.
What a warning! What a gesture!
It was more than a gesture, Father. His Holiness isn't chanting battle masses for dramatic effect. Besides, most people will think he means against the heathen on the other side of the ocean, and justice for our side. Or if they know better, they'll still mean that themselves. He buried his face in his hands and rubbed them up and down. Sleep. What's sleep, Father Leahy? Do you remember? I haven't seen a human face in 10 days that didn't have black circles under its eyes. I could hardly doze last night for somebody screaming over in the guest house.
Lucifer's no sandman, that's true.
What are you staring at out that window? Zerchi demanded sharply. That's another thing. Everybody keeps looking at the sky, staring up and wondering. If it's coming, you won't have time to see it until the flash, and then you'd better not be looking. Stop it. It's unhealthy. Father Leahy turned away from the window.
Yes, Reverend Father. I wasn't watching for that, though. I was watching the buzzards.
Buzzards?
There have been lots of them all day. Dozens of buzzards, just circling.
Where?
Over the Green Star camp down the highway.
That's no omen, then. That's just healthy vulture appetite. Ah, I'm going out for some air. In the courtyard, he met Mrs. Grails. She carried a basket of tomatoes, which she lowered to the ground at his approach.
I brought you somewhat, Father Zerchi,
she told him.
I saw your sign being down, and some poor girl inside the gate, so I reckon you'd not mind a visit by your old tomato woman. I brought you some tomatoes, see?
Thank you, Mrs. Grails. The sign's down because of the refugees, but that's all right. You'll have to see Brother Elton about the tomatoes, though. He does the buying for our kitchen.
Oh, not for buying, Father. I brought them to you for free. You've got lots to feed with all the poor things you're putting up. So they're for free. Where'll I put them?
The emergency kitchen's in the... But no, leave them there. I'll get someone to carry them to the guest house.
Ported them myself. I ported them this far.
She hoisted the basket again. Thank you, Mrs. Grails. He turned to go.
Father, wait,
she called.
A minute, Your Honor. Just a minute of your time.
The abbot suppressed a groan. I'm sorry, Mrs. Grails, but it's as I told you. He stopped, stared at the face of Rachel. For a moment, he had imagined. Had Brother Joshua been right about it? But surely no. It's a matter for your parish and diocese, and there's nothing I can...
No, Father, not that,
she said.
It be somewhat else I wanted to ask of ye.
There, it had smiled. He was certain of it.
Would ye hear my confession, Father? Beg shriveness for bothering ye, but I'm sad for my naughties, and I would it were you as shrives me.
Zerchi hesitated. Why not Father Silo?
I tell ye truthful, Your Honor, it's that the man is an occasion of sin for me. I go meanin' well for the man, but I look once on his face and forget myself. God love him, but I can't.
If he's offended you, you'll have to forgive him.
Forgive, that I do, that I do, but at a goodly distance. He's an occasion of sin for me, I'll tell, for I go losing my temper with him on sight.
Zerchi chuckled. All right, Mrs. Grails, I'll hear your confession, but I've got something I have to do first. Meet me in the Lady Chapel in about half an hour. The first booth. Will that be all right?
Aye, and bless ye, Father.
She nodded profusely. Abbot Zerchi could have sworn that the Rachel head mirrored the nods, ever so slightly. He dismissed the thought and walked over to the garage. A postulant brought out the car for him. He climbed in, dialed his destination, and sank back wearily into the cushions, while the automatic controls engaged the gears and nosed the car toward the gate. In passing the gate, the abbot saw the girl standing at the roadside. The child was with her. Zerchi jabbed at the cancel button. The car stopped.
Waiting, said the robot controls.
The girl wore a cast that enclosed her hips from the waist to left knee. She was leaning on a pair of crutches and panting at the ground.
Somehow she had got out of the guest house and through the gate, but she was obviously unable to go any farther. The child was holding on to one of her crutches and staring at the traffic on the highway. Zerchi opened the car door and climbed out slowly. She looked up at him, but turned her glance quickly away.
"What are you doing out of bed, child?"
he breathed. "You're not supposed to be up. Not with that hip. Just where did you think you were going?" She shifted her weight, and her face twisted with pain.
"To town," she said. "I've got to go. It's urgent."
"Not so urgent that somebody couldn't go do it for you. I'll get brother—"
"No, father, no. Nobody else can do it for me. I've got to go to town."
She was lying. He felt certain she was lying. "All right, then," he said. "I'll take you to town. I'm driving in anyway."
"No, I'll walk. I'm—"
She took a step and gasped. He caught her before she fell. "Not even with St. Christopher holding your crutches could you walk to town, child. Come on now, let's get you back to bed."
"I've got to get to town, I tell you!"
she shrieked angrily. The child, frightened by its mother's anger, began crying monotonously. She tried to calm its fright, but then wilted.
"All right, father. Will you drive me to town?"
"You shouldn't be going at all."
"I tell you, I've got to go."
"All right, then. Let's help you in. The baby, now you." The child screamed hysterically when the priest lifted it into the car beside the mother. It clung to her tightly and resumed the monotonous sobbing. Because of the loose, moist dressings and the singed hair, the child's sex was difficult to determine at a glance, but Abbot Zerchi guessed it to be a girl. He dialed again. The car waited for a break in the traffic, then swerved onto the highway and into the mid-speed lane. 2 minutes later, as they approached the Green Star encampment, he dialed for the slowest lane. 5 monks paraded in front of the tent area, in a solemn hooded picket line. They walked to and fro in procession beneath the Mercy Camp sign, but they were careful to stay on the public right-of-way. Their freshly painted signs read, "Abandon every hope, ye who enter here." Zerchi had intended to stop to talk to them, but with the girl in the car, he contented himself with watching as they drifted past. With their habits and their hoods and their slow funereal procession, the novices were indeed creating the desired effect. Whether the Green Star would be sufficiently embarrassed to move the camp away from the monastery was doubtful, especially since a small crowd of hecklers, as it had been reported to the abbey, had appeared earlier in the day to shout insults and throw pebbles at the signs carried by the pickets. There were 2 police cars parked at the side of the highway, and several officers stood nearby to watch with expressionless faces. Since the crowd of hecklers had appeared quite suddenly, and since the police cars had appeared immediately afterwards, and just in time to witness a heckler trying to seize a picket sign, and since a Green Star official had thereupon gone huffing off to get a court order, the abbot suspected that the heckling had been as carefully staged as the picketing, to enable the Green Star officer to get his writ. It would probably be granted, but until it was served, Abbot Zerchi meant to leave the novices where they were. He glanced at the statue which the camp workers had erected near the gate. It caused a wince. He recognized it as one of the composite human images derived from mass psychological testing, in which subjects were given sketches and photographs of unknown people and asked such questions as, "Which would you most like to meet?" and "Which do you think would make the best parent?" or "Which would you want to avoid?" or "Which do you think is the criminal?" From the photographs selected as the most or the least in terms of the questions, a series of average faces, each to evoke a first-glance personality judgment, had been constructed by computer from the mass test results. This statue, Zerchi was dismayed to notice, bore a marked similarity to some of the most effeminate images by which mediocre, or worse-than-mediocre, artists had traditionally misrepresented the personality of Christ. The sweet, sick face, blank eyes, simpering lips, and arms spread wide in a gesture of embrace. The hips were broad as a woman's, and the chest hinted at breasts, unless those were only folds in the cloak. "Dear Lord of Golgotha," Abbot Zerchi breathed, "is that all the rabble imagine you to be?" He could with effort imagine the statue saying, "Suffer the little children to come unto me," but he could not imagine it saying, "Depart from me into everlasting fire, accursed ones," or flogging the money changers out of the temple. What question, he wondered, had they asked their subjects that conjured in the rabble mind this composite face? It was only anonymously a Christus. The legend on the pedestal said, Comfort. But surely the green star must have seen the resemblance to the traditional pretty Christus of poor artists. But they stuck it in the back of a truck with a red flag tied to its great toe, and the intended resemblance would be hard to prove. The girl had one hand on the door handle. She was eyeing the car's controls. Zerchi swiftly dialed fast lane. The car shot ahead again. She took her hand from the door.
Lots of buzzards today, he said quietly, glancing at the sky out the window.
The girl sat expressionless. He studied her face for a moment. Are you in pain, daughter?
It doesn't matter.
Offer it to heaven, child. She looked at him coldly.
You think it would please God?
If you offer it, yes.
I cannot understand a God who is pleased by my baby's hurting.
The priest winced.
No, no. It is not the pain that is pleasing to God, child. It is the soul's endurance in faith and hope and love, in spite of bodily afflictions, that pleases heaven. Pain is like negative temptation. God is not pleased by temptations that afflict the flesh. He is pleased when the soul rises above the temptation and says, Go, Satan. It's the same with pain, which is often a temptation to despair, anger, loss of faith.
Save your breath, Father. I'm not complaining. The baby is. But the baby doesn't understand your sermon. She can hurt, though. She can hurt, but she can't understand.
What can I say to that? The priest wondered numbly. Tell her again that man was given preternatural impassibility once, but threw it away in Eden? That the child was a cell of Adam, and therefore... It was true, but she had a sick baby, and she was sick herself, and she wouldn't listen.
Don't do it, daughter. Just don't do it.
I'll think about it, she said coldly.
I had a cat once, when I was a boy, the abbot murmured slowly. He was a big gray tomcat, with shoulders like a small bulldog, and a head and neck to match, and that sort of slouchy insolence that makes some of them look like the devil's own. He was pure cat. Do you know cats?
A little.
Cat lovers don't know cats. You can't love all cats if you know cats, and the ones you can love, if you know them, are the ones the cat lovers don't even like. Zeke was that kind of cat.
This has a moral, of course.
She was watching him suspiciously.
Only that I killed him.
Stop! Whatever you're about to say, stop!
A truck hit him, crushed his back legs. He dragged himself under the house. Once in a while he'd make a noise like a cat fight and thrash around a little, but mostly he just lay quietly and waited. He ought to be destroyed, they kept telling me. After a few hours, he dragged himself from under the house, crying for help. He ought to be destroyed, they said. I wouldn't let them do it. They said it was cruel to let him live. So finally, I said I'd do it myself, if it had to be done. I got a gun and a shovel and took him out to the edge of the woods. I stretched him out on the ground while I dug a hole. Then I shot him through the head. It was a small-bore rifle. Zeke thrashed a couple of times, then got up and started dragging himself towards some bushes. I shot him again. It knocked him flat, so I thought he was dead, and put him in the hole. After a couple of shovels of dirt, Zeke got up and pulled himself out of the hole and started for the bushes again. I was crying louder than the cat. I had to kill him with the shovel. I had to put him back in the hole and use the blade of the shovel like a cleaver. And while I was chopping with it, Zeke was still thrashing around. They told me later it was just spinal reflex, but I didn't believe it. I knew that cat. He wanted to get to those bushes and just lie there and wait. I wished to God that I had only let him get to those bushes and die the way a cat would, if you just let it alone, with dignity. I never felt right about it. Zeke was only a cat, but...
Shut up,
she whispered. But even the ancient pagans noticed that nature imposes nothing on you, that nature doesn't prepare you to bear. If that is true even of a cat, then is it not more perfectly true of a creature with rational intellect and will,
whatever you may believe of heaven.
Shut up, Daniel, shut up!
She hissed. If I am being a little brutal, said the priest, then it is to you, not to the baby. The baby, as you say, can't understand, and you, as you say, are not complaining. Therefore
you're asking me to let her die slowly, and—
No, I'm not asking you. As a priest of Christ, I am commanding you, by the authority of Almighty God, not to lay hands on your child, not to offer her life in sacrifice to a false god of expedient mercy. I do not advise you. I adjure and command you, in the name of Christ the King. Is that clear?
Dom Zerchi had never spoken with such a voice before, and the ease with which the words came to his lips surprised even the priest. As he continued to look at her, her eyes fell. For an instant he had feared that the girl would laugh in his face. When Holy Church occasionally hinted that she still considered her authority to be supreme over all nations and superior to the authority of states, men in these times tended to snicker. And yet the authenticity of the command could still be sensed by a bitter girl with a dying child. It had been brutal to try to reason with her, and he regretted it. A simple, direct command might accomplish what persuasion could not. She needed the voice of authority now, more than she needed persuasion. He could see it by the way she had wilted, although he had spoken the command as gently as his voice could manage. They drove into the city. Zerchi stopped to post a letter, stopped at St. Michael's to speak for a few minutes with Father Silo about the refugee problem, stopped again at ZDI for a copy of the latest civil defense directive. Each time he returned to the car, he half expected the girl to be gone, but she sat quietly holding the baby and absently stared toward infinity. "Are you going to tell me where you wanted to go, child?" he asked at last.
"Nowhere. I've changed my mind."
He smiled. "But you were so urgent about getting to town."
"Forget it, Father. I've changed my mind."
"Good. Then we'll go back home. Why don't you let the sisters take care of your daughter for a few days?"
"I'll think about it."
The car sped back along the highway toward the abbey. As they approached the Green Star camp, he could see that something was wrong. The pickets were no longer marching their tour. They had gathered in a group and were talking, or listening, to the officers and a third man that Zerchi could not identify. He switched the car over to the slow lane. One of the novices saw the car, recognized it, and began waving his sign. Dom Zerchi had no intention of stopping while the girl was in the car, but one of the officers stepped out into the slow lane just ahead of them and pointed his traffic baton at the vehicle's obstruction detectors. The autopilot reacted automatically and brought the car to a stop. The officer waved the car off the road. Zerchi could not disobey. The two police officers approached, paused to note license numbers and demand papers. One of them glanced in curiously at the girl and the child, took note of the red tickets. The other waved toward the now stationary picket line.
"So you're the bejesus behind all this, are you?" he grunted at the abbot. "Well, the gentleman in the brown tunic over there has a little news for you. I think you'd better listen."
He jerked his head toward a chubby courtroom type who came pompously toward them. The child was crying again. The mother stirred restlessly. "Officers, this girl and baby aren't well. I'll accept the process, but please let us drive on back to the abbey now. Then I'll come back alone." The officer looked at the girl again.
"Ma'am?"
She stared toward the camp and looked up at the statue towering over the entrance.
"I'm getting out here,"
she told them tonelessly.
"You'll be better off, ma'am," said the officer, eyeing the red tickets again.
"No!"
Dom Zerchi caught her arm.
"Child, I forbid you!"
The officer's hand shot out to seize the priest's wrist.
"Let go!"
he snapped. Then softly,
"Ma'am, are you his ward or something?"
"No."
"Where do you get off forbidding the lady to get out?"
the officer demanded.
"We're just a little impatient with you, mister, and it had better be—"
Zerchi ignored him and spoke rapidly to the girl. She shook her head.
"The baby, then. Let me take the baby back to the sisters. I insist—"
"Ma'am, is that your child?"
the officer asked. The girl was already out of the car, but Zerchi was holding the child. The girl nodded.
"She's mine."
"Has he been holding you prisoner or something?"
"No."
"What do you want to do, ma'am?"
She paused.
Get back in the car, Domzerchi told her.
You cut that tone of voice, mister,
the officer barked. Lady, what about the kid?
We're both getting out here, she said.
Zerchi slammed the door and tried to start the car, but the officer's hand flashed in through the window, hit the cancel button, and removed the key.
Attempted kidnapping? One officer grunted to the other. Maybe, said the other, and opened the door. Now let go of the woman's baby.
To let it be murdered here? The abbot asked. You'll have to use force.
Go around to the other side of the car, Fal.
No.
Now, just a little baton under the armpit. That's it. Pull.
All right, lady, there's your kid.
No, I guess you can't, not with those crutches.
Kors?
Where's Kors? Hey, Doc.
Abbot Zerchi caught a glimpse of a familiar face coming through the crowd.
Lift the kid out while we hold this nut, will you?
Doctor and priest exchanged a silent glance, and then the baby was lifted from the car. The officers released the abbot's wrists. One of them turned and found himself hemmed in by novices with upraised signs. He interpreted the signs as potential weapons, and his hand dropped to his gun.
Back up,
he snapped. Bewildered, the novices moved back.
Get out.
The abbot climbed out of the car. He found himself facing the chubby court official. The latter tapped him on the arm with a folded paper.
You have just been served with a restraining order, which I am required by the court to read and explain to you. Here is your copy. The officers are witnesses that you have been confronted with it, so you cannot resist service.
Oh, give it here.
That's the right attitude. Now, you are directed by the court as follows. Whereas the plaintiff alleges that a great public nuisance has been...
Throw the signs in the ash barrel over there, Zerchi instructed his novices. Unless somebody objects. Then climb in the car and wait. He paid no attention to the reading of the order, but approached the officers while the process server trailed behind, reading in monotonous staccato. Am I under arrest?
We're thinking about it.
And to appear before this court on the aforesaid date to show cause why an injunction...
Any particular charge?
We could make 4 or 5 charges stick, if you want it that way.
Kors came back through the gate. The woman and her child had been escorted into the camp area. The doctor's expression was grave, if not guilty.
Listen, father, he said. I know how you feel about all this, but...
Abbot Zerchi's fist shot out at the doctor's face in a straight right jab. It caught Kors off balance, and he sat down hard in the driveway. He looked bewildered. He snuffled a few times. Suddenly his nose leaked blood. The police had the priest's arms pinned behind him.
And herein fail not, the process server jabbered on, lest a decree pro confesso.
Take him over to the car, said one of the officers.
The car toward which the abbot was led was not his own, but the police cruiser.
The judge will be a little disappointed in you,
the officer told him sourly.
Now stand still right there and be quiet. One move and you go in the locks.
The abbot and the officer waited by the cruiser, while the process server, the doctor, and the other officer conferred in the driveway. Kors was pressing a handkerchief to his nose. They talked for 5 minutes. Thoroughly ashamed, Zerchi pressed his forehead against the metal of the car and tried to pray. It mattered little to him at the moment what they might decide to do. He could think only of the girl and the child. He was certain she had been ready to change her mind, had needed only the command, I, a priest of God, adjure thee, and the grace to hear it. If only they had not forced him to stop where she could witness God's priest summarily overruled by Caesar's traffic cop. Never to him had Christ's kingship seemed more distant.
All right, mister. You're a lucky nut, I'll say that.
Zerchi looked up.
What? Dr. Kors refuses to file a complaint. He says he had one coming. Why did you hit him?
Ask him.
We did. I'm just trying to decide whether we take you in or just give you the summons. The court officer says you're well known hereabouts. What do you do?
Zerchi reddened. Doesn't this mean anything to you? He touched his pectoral cross.
Not when the guy wearing it punches somebody in the nose. What do you do?
Zerchi swallowed the last trace of his pride. I am the abbot of the Brothers of St. Leibowitz at the abbey you see down the road.
That gives you a license to commit assault?
I'm sorry. If Dr. Kors will hear me, I'll apologize. If you give me a summons, I promise to appear.
Al, the jail's full of DPs. Listen, if we just forget the whole thing, will you stay away from this place and keep your gang out there where they belong?
Yes.
All right, get moving. But if you so much as drive past here and spit, that'll be it.
Thank you. A calliope was playing somewhere in the park as they drove away, and, looking back, Zerchi saw that the carousel was turning. One officer mopped his face, clapped the process server on the back, and they all went to their cars and drove away. Even with five novices in the car, Zerchi was alone with his shame. 29.
I believe you've been warned about that temper before,
Father Leahy demanded of the penitent. Yes, Father.
You realize that the intent was relatively murderous.
There was no intent to kill.
Are you trying to excuse yourself?
The confessor demanded. No, Father. The intent was to hurt. I accuse myself of violating the spirit of the Fifth Commandment in thought and deed, and of sinning against charity and justice, and bringing disgrace and scandal upon my office.
You realize that you have broken a promise never to resort to violence?
Yes, Father. I deeply regret it.
And the only mitigating circumstance is that you just saw red and swung. Do you often let yourself abandon reason like that?
The Inquisition continued, with the ruler of the abbey on his knees and the prior sitting in judgment over his master.
All right, Father Leahy said at last. Now for your penance. Promise to say...
Zerchi was an hour and a half late getting to the chapel, but Mrs. Grails was still waiting. She was kneeling in a pew near the confessional, and she seemed half asleep. Embarrassed within himself, the abbot had hoped that she would not be there. He had his own penance to say before he could hear her. He knelt near the altar and spent 20 minutes finishing the prayers Father Leahy had assigned him as penance for that day. But when he moved back toward the confessional, Mrs. Grails was still there. He spoke to her twice before she heard him, and when she rose, she stumbled a little. She paused to feel at the Rachel face, exploring its eyelids and lips with withered fingers. "Is something wrong, daughter?" he asked. She looked up at the high windows. Her eyes wandered about the vaulted ceiling.
"Aye, father,"
she whispered.
"I feel the Dread One about. I do. The Dread One's close, very close about us here. I feel need of shriveness, father, and something else as well."
"Something else, Mrs. Grails?" She leaned close to whisper behind her hand.
"I need be giving shriveness to him as well."
The priest recoiled slightly. "To whom? I don't understand."
"Shriveness to him who made me as I am,"
she whimpered. But then a slow smile spread her mouth.
I never forgave him for it."
"Forgive God? How can you... He is just. He is justice. He is love. How can you say..." Her eyes pleaded with him.
"Mayn't an old tomato woman forgive him just a little for his justice, afore I be asking his shriveness on me?"
Dom Zerchi swallowed a dry place. He glanced down at her bicephalous shadow on the floor. It hinted at a terrible justice, this shadow shape. He could not bring himself to reprove her for choosing the word forgive. In her simple world, it was conceivable to forgive justice as well as to forgive injustice, for man to pardon God as well as for God to pardon man. "So be it, then, and bear with her, Lord," he thought, adjusting his stole. She genuflected toward the altar before they entered the confessional, and the priest noticed that when she crossed herself, her hand touched Rachel's forehead as well as her own. He brushed back the heavy curtain, slipped into his half of the booth, and whispered through the grill.
"What do you seek, daughter?" "Blessings, father, for I have sinned."
She spoke haltingly. He could not see her through the mesh that covered the grill. There was only the low and rhythmic whimper of a voice of Eve. The same, everlastingly the same, and even a woman with two heads could not contrive new ways of courting evil, but could only pursue a mindless mimicry of the original. Still feeling the shame of his own behavior with the girl and the officers and Kors, he found it hard to concentrate. Still, his hands shook as he listened. The rhythm of the words came dull and muffled through the grill, like the rhythm of distant hammering, spikes driven through palms, piercing timber. As Alter Christus, he sensed the weight of each burden for a moment before it passed on to the one who bore them all. There was the business about her mate. There were the murky and secret things, things to be wrapped in dirty newspaper and buried by night. That he could only make sense of a little of it seemed to make the horror worse.
"If you are trying to say that you are guilty of abortion," he whispered, "I must tell you that the absolution is reserved for the bishop, and I can't—"
He paused. There was a distant roaring, and the faint snort growl of missiles being fired from the range.
"The Dread One! The Dread One!"
whined the old woman. His scalp prickled, a sudden chill of unreasonable alarm.
"Quickly, an act of contrition," he muttered. 10 aves, 10 pater nosters for your penance. You'll have to repeat the confession again later, but now an act of contrition."
He heard her murmuring from the other side of the grill. Swiftly, he breathed an absolution.
"Te absolvat Dominus Jesus Christus. Ego autem ius auctoritate te absolve ab omni vinculo. Denique si absolvi potes, ex peccatis tuis ego te absolvo in nomine Patris."
Before he had finished, a light was shining through the thick curtain of the confessional door. The light grew brighter and brighter until the booth was full of bright noon. The curtain began to smoke.
"Wait, wait," he hissed. "Wait till it dies."
"Wait, wait, wait till it dies,"
echoed a strange soft voice from beyond the grill. It was not the voice of Mrs. Grayles.
"Mrs. Grayles? Mrs. Grayles?"
She answered him in a thick-tongued, sleepy murmur.
I never meant to love.
It trailed away. It was not the same voice that had answered him a moment ago.
"Now, quickly, run!"
Not waiting to see that she heeded him, he bounded out of the confessional and ran down the aisle toward the altar of reservation. The light had dimmed, but it still roasted the skin with noon sun glare.
How many seconds remained?
The church was full of smoke. He vaulted into the sanctuary, stumbled over the first step, called it a genuflection, and went to the altar. With frantic hands, he removed the Christ-filled ciborium from the tabernacle, genuflected again before the presence, grabbed up the body of his God, and ran for it. The building fell in on him. When he awoke, there was nothing but dust. He was pinned to the ground at the waist. He lay on his belly in the dirt and tried to move. One arm was free, but the other was caught under the weight that held him down. His free hand still clutched the ciborium, but he had tipped it in falling, and the top had come off, spilling several of the small hosts. The blast had swept him clean out of the church, he decided. He lay in sand and saw the remains of a rose bush caught in a rock fall. A rose remained attached to a branch of it, one of the salmon Armenians, he noticed. The petals were singed. There was a great roaring of engines in the sky, and blue lights kept winking through the dust. He felt no pain at first. He tried to crane his neck so as to get a look at the behemoth that sat on him, but then things started hurting. His eyes filmed. He cried out softly. He would not look back again. 5 tons of rock had tucked him in. It held whatever remained of him below the waist. He began recovering the little hosts. He moved his free arm gingerly. Cautiously, he picked each of them out of the sand. The wind threatened to send the small flakes of Christ wandering.
"Anyway, Lord, I tried," he thought. "Anyone needing the last rites? Viaticum? They'll have to drag themselves to me if they do. Or is anybody left?"
He could hear no voices above the terrible roaring. A trickle of blood kept seeping into his eyes. He wiped at it with his forearm so as to avoid staining the wafers with gory fingers.
"Wrong blood, Lord. Mine, not yours. Te alba me."
He returned most of the scattered victim to the vessel, but a few fugitive flakes eluded his reach. He stretched for them, but blacked out again.
"Jesus, Mary, Joseph, help!"
Faintly, he heard an answer, distant and scarcely audible under the howling sky. It was the soft, strange voice he had heard in the confessional, and again it echoed his words.
"Jesus, Mary, Joseph, help!"
"What?"
he cried. He called out several times, but no further answer came. The dust had begun sprinkling down. He replaced the lid of the ciborium to keep the dust from mingling with the wafers. He lay still for a time with his eyes closed. The trouble with being a priest was that you eventually had to take the advice you gave to others. Nature imposes nothing that nature hasn't prepared you to bear. That's what I get for telling her what the Stoic said before I told her what God said, he thought. There was little pain, but only a ferocious itching that came from the captive part of him. He tried to scratch. His fingers encountered only bare rock. He clawed at it for a moment, shuddered, and took his hand away. The itch was maddening. Bruised nerves flashed foolish demands for scratching. He felt very undignified.
Well, Dr. Kors, how do you know that the itch is not the more basic evil than the pain?
He laughed a little at that one. The laugh caused a sudden blackout. He clawed his way out of the blackness to the accompaniment of someone screaming. Suddenly the priest knew that the screaming was his own. Zerchi was suddenly afraid. The itch had been transmuted into agony, but the screams had been those of raw terror, not of pain. There was agony now even in breathing. The agony persisted, but he could bear that. The dread had arisen from that last taste of inky blackness. The blackness seemed to brood over him, covet him, await him hungrily. A big black appetite with a yen for souls. Pain he could bear, but not that awful dark. Either there was something in it that should not be there, or there was something here that remained to be done. Once he surrendered to that darkness, there would be nothing he could do or undo. Ashamed of his fright, he tried to pray, but the prayers seemed somehow unprayerful, like apologies, but not petitions, as if the last prayer had already been said, the last canticle already sung. The fear persisted. Why? He tried to reason with it.
You've seen people die, Jeth. Seen many people die. It looks easy. They taper off, and then there's a little spasm, and it's over.
That inky dark gulf between Aham and Asti, blackest Styx, abyss between Lord and man.
Listen, Jeff, you really believe there's something on the other side of it, don't you? Then why are you shaking so?
A verse from the Dies Irae drifted into mind, and it nagged at him.
Quid sum miser tunc dicturus, quem patronum rogaturus, cum vix justus sit securus? What am I, who am wretched, then to say? Whom shall I ask to be my protector, since even the just man is scarcely safe? Vix securus? Why scarcely safe? Surely he would not damn the just? Then why are you shaking so? Really, Dr. Kors, the evil to which even you should have referred was not suffering, but the unreasoning fear of suffering. Metus doloris, take it together with its positive equivalent, the craving for worldly security, for Eden, and you might have your root of evil, Dr. Kors. To minimize suffering and to maximize security were natural and proper ends of society and Caesar, but then they became the only ends somehow, and the only basis of law. A perversion. Inevitably, then, in seeking only them, we found only their opposites, maximum suffering and minimum security. The trouble with the world is me. Try that on yourself, my dear Kors. The, me, Adam, man, we. No worldly evil, except that which is introduced into the world by man. Me, thee, Adam, us. With a little help from the father of lies. Blame anything, blame God even, but oh, don't blame me. Dr. Kors, the only evil in the world now, Doctor, is the fact that the world no longer is. What pain hath wrought?
He laughed weakly again, and it brought the ink. Me, us, Adam, but Christ, man, me. Me, us, Adam, but Christ, man, me, he said aloud. You know what, Pat? They'd, together, rather get nailed on it, but not alone. When they bleed, want company. Because why it is the same as Satan wants man full of hell. I mean, the same as Satan wants hell full of man. Because Adam, and yet Christ, but still me. Listen, Pat. This time it took longer to drive the inky dark away, but he had to make it clear to Pat before he went into it all the way.
Listen, Pat, because
why it is I told her the baby had to... is why I... I mean, Jesus never asked a man to do a damn thing that Jesus didn't do. Same as why I... why I can't let go. Pat?
He blinked several times. Pat vanished. The world congealed again, and the blackness was gone. Somehow he had discovered what he was afraid of. There was something he had yet to fulfill before that dark closed over him forever.
Dear God, let me live long enough to fulfill it.
He was afraid to die before he had accepted as much suffering as that which came to the child who could not comprehend it, the child he had tried to save for further suffering. No, not for it, but in spite of it. He had commanded the mother in the name of Christ. He had not been wrong, but now he was afraid to slide away into that blackness before he had endured as much as God might help him endure.
Quem patronum rogaturus, cum vix justus sit securus.
Let it be for the child and her mother, then. What I impose, I must accept. Fas est. The decision seemed to diminish the pain. He lay quietly for a time, then cautiously looked back at the rock heap again. More than 5 tons back there. 18 centuries back there. The blast had broken open the crypts, for he noticed a few bones caught between the rocks. He groped with his free hand, encountered something smooth, and finally worked it free. He dropped it in the sand beside the ciborium. The jawbone was missing, but the cranium was intact, except for a hole in the forehead, from which a sliver of dry and half-rotten wood protruded. It looked like the remains of an arrow. The skull seemed very old.
Brother,
he whispered, for none but a monk of the order would have been buried in those crypts.
What did you do for them, Bone? Teach them to read and write, help them rebuild, give them Christ, help restore a culture. Did you remember to warn them that it could never be Eden? Of course you did. Bless you, Bone, he thought, and traced a cross on his forehead with his thumb. For all your pains, they paid you with an arrow between the eyes. Because there's more than 5 tons and 18 centuries of rock back there. I suppose there's about 2 million years of it back there, since the first of Homo Inspiratus.
He heard the voice again, the soft echo voice that had answered him a little while ago. This time it came in a kind of childish sing-song.
La-la-la, la-la-la.
Although it seemed to be the same voice he had heard in the confessional, surely it could not be Mrs. Grail's. Mrs. Grail's would have forgiven God and run for home if she had got out of the chapel in time. And please forgive the reversal, Lord. But he was not even sure that it was a reversal.
Listen, old Bone, should I have told that to Coors? Listen, my dear Coors, why don't you forgive God for allowing pain? If he didn't allow it, human courage, bravery, nobility, and self-sacrifice would all be meaningless things. Besides, you'd be out of a job, Coors. Maybe that's what we forgot to mention, Bone. Bombs and tantrums, when the world grew bitter because the world fell somehow short of half-remembered Eden. The bitterness was essentially against God. Listen, man, you have to give up the bitterness. Be granting shriveness to God, as she'd say. Before anything. Before love. But bombs and tantrums, they didn't forgive.
He slept a while. It was natural sleep, and not that ugly mind-seizing nothingness of the dark. A rain came, clearing the dust. When he awoke, he was not alone. He lifted his cheek out of the mud and looked at them crossly. 3 of them sat on the rubble heap and eyed him with funereal solemnity. He moved. They spread black wings and hissed nervously. He flipped a bit of stone at them. 2 of them took wing and climbed to circle, but the 3rd sat there doing a little shuffle dance and peering at him gravely. A dark and ugly bird, but not like that other dark. This one coveted only the body.
"Dinner's not quite ready, Brother Bird," he told it irritably. "You'll have to wait."
It would not have many meals to look forward to, he noticed, before the bird itself became a meal for another. Its feathers were singed from the flash. It kept one eye closed. The bird was soggy with rain, and the abbot guessed that the rain itself was full of death.
La la la, la la la, wait, wait, wait till it dies, la.
The voice came again. Xerchi had feared that it might have been a hallucination, but the bird was hearing it too. It kept peering at something out of Xerchi's range of vision. At last it hissed raucously and took wing.
Help!
He shouted weakly.
Help!
Parroted the strange voice. And the two-headed woman wandered into sight around a heap of rubble. She stopped and looked down at Xerchi.
Thank God! Mrs. Grails! See if you can find Father Leahy!
Thank God, Mrs. Grails. See if you can...
He blinked away a film of blood and studied her closely.
Rachel,
he breathed.
Rachel,
the creature answered. She knelt there in front of him and settled back on her heels. She watched him with cool green eyes and smiled innocently. The eyes were alert with wonder, curiosity, and perhaps something else. But she could apparently not see that he was in pain. There was something about her eyes that caused him to notice nothing else for several seconds. But then he noticed that the head of Mrs. Grails slept soundly on the other shoulder while Rachel smiled. It seemed a young, shy smile that hoped for friendship. He tried again.
Listen, is anyone else alive? Get...
Melodious and solemn came her answer.
Listen, is anyone else alive?
She savored the words. She enunciated them distinctly. She smiled over them. Her lips reframed them when her voice was done with them. It was more than reflexive imitation, he decided. She was trying to communicate something. By the repetition, she was trying to convey the idea, I am somehow like you. But she had only just now been born.
And you're somehow different, too,
Xerchi noticed with a trace of awe. He remembered that Mrs. Grails had arthritis in both knees, but the body which had belonged to her was now kneeling there and sitting back on its heels in that limber posture of youth. Moreover, the old woman's wrinkled skin seemed less wrinkled than before, and it seemed to glow a little, as if horny old tissue were being revivified. Suddenly he noticed her arm.
You're hurt.
You're hurt.
Xerchi pointed at her arm. Instead of looking where he pointed, she imitated his gesture, looking at his finger and extending her own to touch it, using the wounded arm. There was very little blood, but there were at least a dozen cuts, and one looked deep. He tugged at her finger to bring her arm closer. He plucked out 5 slivers of broken glass. Either she had thrust her arm through a window, or, more likely, had been in the path of an exploding window pane when the blast had come. Only once, when he removed an inch-long lance of glass, did a trace of blood appear. When he pulled the others free, they left tiny blue marks, with no bleeding. The effect reminded him of a demonstration of hypnosis he had once witnessed, of something he had dismissed as a hoax. When he looked up at her face again, his awe increased. She was still smiling at him, as if the removal of the glass splinters had caused her no discomfort. He glanced again at the face of Mrs. Grails. It had grown gray with the impersonal mask of coma. The lips seemed bloodless. Somehow he felt certain it was dying. He could imagine it withering and eventually falling away, like a scab or an umbilical cord. Who, then, was Rachel? And what? There was still a little moisture on the rain-wet rocks. He moistened one fingertip and beckoned for her to lean closer. Whatever she was, she had probably received too much radiation to live very long. He began tracing a cross on her forehead with the moist fingertip.
Nisi baptizata es et nisi baptizare nonquis te baptizo.
He got no farther than that. She leaned quickly away from him. Her smile froze and vanished. No! Her whole countenance seemed to shout. She turned away from him. She wiped the trace of moisture from her forehead, closed her eyes, and let her hands lie limply in her lap. An expression of complete passivity came over her face. With her head bowed that way, her whole attitude seemed suggestive of prayer. Gradually, out of the passivity, a smile was reborn. It grew. When she opened her eyes and looked at him again, it was with the same open warmth as before, but she glanced around as if searching for something. Her eyes fell on the ciborium. Before he could stop her, she picked it up.
No!
He coughed hoarsely and made a grab for it. She was too quick for him, and the effort cost him a blackout. As he drifted back to consciousness and lifted his head again, he could see only through a blur. She was still kneeling there, facing him. Finally, he could make out that she was holding the golden cup in her left hand, and in her right, delicately, between thumb and forefinger, a single host. She was offering it to him, or was he only imagining it, as he had imagined a while ago that he was talking to Brother Pat? He waited for the blur to clear. This time it wasn't going to clear, not completely.
Domine, non sum dignus, he whispered. Sed tantum dic verbo.
He received the wafer from her hand. She replaced the lid of the ciborium and set the vessel in a more protected spot under a jutting rock. She used no conventional gestures, but the reverence with which she had handled it convinced him of one thing. She sensed the presence under the veils. She who could not yet use words nor understand them had done what she had as if by direct instruction, in response to his attempt at conditional baptism. He tried to refocus his eyes to get another look at the face of this being, who by gestures alone had said to him, I do not need your first sacrament, man, but I am worthy to convey to you this sacrament of life. Now he knew what she was, and he sobbed faintly when he could not again force his eyes to focus on those cool, green, and untroubled eyes of one born free.
Magnificat anima mea dominum, he whispered. My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit hath rejoiced in God my Savior, for he hath regarded the lowliness of his handmaid.
He wanted to teach her these words as his last act, for he was certain that she shared something with the maiden who first had spoken them.
Magnificat anima mea dominum, et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo, salutare meo, quia respexit humanitatem.
He ran out of breath before he had finished. His vision went foggy. He could no longer see her form. But cool fingertips touched his forehead, and he heard her say one word.
Live.
Then she was gone. He could hear her voice trailing away in the new ruins.
La la la. La la la.
The image of those cool green eyes lingered with him as long as life. He did not ask why God would choose to raise up a creature of primal innocence from the shoulder of Mrs. Grails, or why God gave to it the preternatural gifts of Eden, those gifts which man had been trying to seize by brute force again from heaven, since first he lost them. He had seen primal innocence in those eyes, and a promise of resurrection. One glimpse had been a bounty, and he wept in gratitude. Afterwards he lay with his face in the wet dirt and waited. Nothing else ever came. Nothing that he saw or felt or heard. 30. They sang as they lifted the children into the ship. They sang old space shanties and helped the children up the ladder one at a time and into the hands of the sisters. They sang heartily to dispel the fright of the little ones. When the horizon erupted, the singing stopped. They passed the last child into the ship. The horizon came alive with flashes as the monks mounted the ladder. The horizons became a red glow. A distant cloud bank was born where no cloud had been. The monks on the ladder looked away from the flashes. When the flashes were gone, they looked back. The visage of Lucifer mushroomed into hideousness above the cloud bank, rising slowly like some titan climbing to its feet after ages of imprisonment in the earth. Someone barked an order. The monks began climbing again. Soon they were all inside the ship. The last monk, upon entering, paused in the lock. He stood in the open hatchway and took off his sandals.
Sic transit mundus,
he murmured, looking back at the glow. He slapped the soles of his sandals together, beating the dirt out of them. The glow was engulfing a third of the heavens. He scratched his beard, took one last look at the ocean, then stepped back and closed the hatch. There came a blur, a glare of light, a high, thin, whining sound, and the starship thrust itself heavenward. The breakers beat monotonously at the shores, casting up driftwood. An abandoned seaplane floated beyond the breakers. After a while, the breakers caught the seaplane and threw it on the shore with the driftwood. It tilted and fractured a wing. There were shrimp carousing in the breakers, and the whiting that fed on the shrimp, and the shark that munched the whiting and found them admirable in the sportive brutality of the sea. A wind came across the ocean, sweeping with it a pall of fine white ash. The ash fell into the sea and into the breakers. The breakers washed dead shrimp ashore with the driftwood. Then they washed up the whiting. The shark swam out to his deepest waters and brooded in the old clean currents. He was very hungry that season. This concludes the reading of A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Copyright 1959 by Walter M. Miller, Jr. This book was read by Tom Weiner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the estate of Walter M. Miller, Jr., and was produced in 2011 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.